CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
On today's In the Motherhood for November 17th, 2021, I'm featuring a recent broadcast from Canadian radio show Wings with host Frida Worden. Thanks to Frida and Wings for letting us borrow your content here on In the Motherhood. I'm your host, Robin Fadden, for tonight, November 17th. Happy Wednesday night in this sort of snowy Montreal weather. We'll see. So what we'll be featuring today on In the Motherhood is a radio documentary covering the Women's Agenda to Save the Planet, which offers insights into how long people around the world, especially women, have been demanding climate sustainability and climate action from governments and corporations. And the Women's Agenda to Save the Planet happened 30 years ago in Miami, and it included 1,500 women from 80 countries in a tribunal and think tank to plan for sustainability of life on Earth, with an outcome of forming demands for the UN Rio Summit on Environment and Development. So that was in 1991. Today, we can clearly see the environmental situation they predicted back then, and we can also see reflections of it in the recent COP26 talks in Glasgow. The question now is whether the world's leaders will adopt the measures needed within a time frame that could make a difference to the current climate crisis around the world. We'll go to those talks now, a little insight into history, a little slice of history. It's so interesting to listen back 30 years ago to what people were talking about then with the context in mind of where we are now. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Today from the Wings Archive, Women's Agenda to Save the Planet. Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
When American women first started speaking and writing about their status as second-class citizens, they gathered at a small little town, Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848, to write down their complaints and demands in a manifesto, the Declaration of the Sentiments of Women. What we have witnessed here in the past few days is the making of a new women's declaration, a 21st century declaration, a declaration of reclamation. And why shouldn't women speak up and reclaim our natural systems? Who has a better right to do so than those of us who have been so connected with life itself, with nature, with the earth and its bounty, and what it has to produce for future generations?
Former U.S. Congresswoman Bella Abzug convened the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet in Miami, 1991. There, 1,500 women from 83 countries co-wrote an agenda to save the planet. Many of their ideas were adopted at the 1992 UN Earth Summit in Rio, but no countries have yet met the challenge of Women's Agenda 21. Here are highlights from testimony and discussions at that 1991 meeting. Peggy Antrobus of Barbados reads from the preamble.
People everywhere are frightened by evidence of the deterioration of the life-giving systems of the earth. We, women of many nations, have come together to voice our concern for the health and well-being of our living planet and all its life forms.
Yuvigui Dahani Wahu.
Marjorie Walden.
The clan chieftainess of the Ani Godowa clan, of the Etowah band, of the Eastern Tislegi or Cherokee Nation, has asked me to bring these words here to Miami for the women to hear. And I will read her words for you. At this gathering of women who are cultivating the long view for the protection of the environment for the future generations, may everyone's heart be guided by the cries of those yet to be born. In that we can all call Earth our home, it is wise that the same caretaking mind of the mothers also become the mindfulness of planning a future beneficial to all our relations. We are on the verge of new technologies that are based on the interaction of our minds and the crystal instructions of communication systems. This new technology in many ways reflects the ancient tradition of prayer, where each person considers that they may contribute to the circle of well-being. So, as so many women meet, I pray that you will consider first reconstructing pathways of reconciliation, that communities that were once at odds with one another and the environment may learn how deeply we are interconnected. Consider that animals keep their dens clean, and that our awareness that our home is the earth is ever increasing. I applaud this meeting as another step in building communication between various ethnic groups and nations, that we may cooperatively plant seeds of a future where all children are wanted, loved, and cared for, and women and men see themselves as cooperative partners in building communities of mutual support. Yuvigui Dahani Wahu. Thank you.
We come together as a privileged few who speak on behalf of those who could not be with us, the millions of women who experience daily the violence of poverty, environmental degradation, and exploitation of their work and bodies due to an international economic order that places capital before human and ecological well-being.
I speak from organizations which work with communities on the ground. And I would like to take you to two communities which represent the very crisis that is affecting the people of the third world.
Meenakshi Rahman of Malaysia.
Now, in Sarawak, Malaysia, many of you must have heard of the rapid depletion of the rainforest. There, native women and children, with their menfolk, blockade right now, this very moment, on timber roads to stop timber companies from ravaging the forest. And I would like to give the testimony of one of the native people. Many people ask us if we want to retain our traditional way of life forever, whether our staying in the forest areas will hinder national progress. This is not the central issue for us. Of course we want development, if it means schools and clinics and basic facilities. But if by development you mean logging, then we are against it, because logging brings ruin and not development for us. Another case, a group of women who are fight in the forefront of a multinational corporation, Mitsubishi Chemicals. Theirs is the struggle to defend their health of their children and themselves. Radioactive waste is dumped in their backyard, sold as fertilizer and brought to their homes and to be put on flower pots, because this is what the company tells them. Children have died of leukemia, and I still remember visiting the hospital of a 10-year-old dying of leukemia, and this little girl just died this year. Now, they ask us, why do we have to pay the price for the consumption of the elite few of the world?
We have listened to each other speak of the ills of our societies, our families, and our sacred nature. We have been inspired by the courage and commitment of our sisters throughout the world who protect and repair our natural heritage. Yet we know their efforts will be in vain if pollution, overexploitation, and disregard for the integrity of nature does not cease.
I think much of our environmental degradation, or much of the escalation of it, has occurred since World War II. And it's rather mind-boggling to realize that in that period of time, between 70,000 and 100,000 new toxic chemicals have been dumped into our air and water and land. It's also mind-boggling to realize that the majority of these were deliberately created to kill the earth and to do mass destruction of people. They come to us from the military sector.
Dr. Rosalie Bertel of Canada.
We have had a massive brain drain into production of biological, atomic, and chemical warfare agents. This is the secretive part of our society. We have a civil society, and we try to solve all our problems in the civil society. But we have a runaway, rampant, militaristic sector, which is secret, and which is causing the majority of the problems. I would like to turn the spotlight on this militaristic sector. The multinational corporations work in both sectors. They create these military horrors, and at the same time, they try to find spin-offs for commercial consumption, which they then push on the unsuspecting public to cheapen the price for the military. This has occurred in many sectors. The most obvious is the nuclear. And this has involved the uranium mining and milling on the area of the indigenous people in Australia, in Namibia, in Zaire, in the native land of North and South America. This production of uranium would not take place if the only outcome were nuclear bombs. But there is a myth out there that there is a peaceful atom, and this industry is foisted on people for the little civilian commercial payoff in terms of electricity, which is also extremely polluting. Our universities would not teach nuclear physics or nuclear engineering if the only jobs were producing weapons of mass destruction. So there has to be, from the military viewpoint, some commercial legitimating industries, or they cannot get the support of ordinary people. Now, these are wolves in sheep's clothing. The pesticides, herbicides, defoliants, these were produced to kill the jungle in Vietnam so that you could see the enemy, so that you could fight in a jungle. And they have been sold all over the world to destroy agriculture as if they were wonderful new products of our culture. Again, they are wolves in sheep's clothing. And how can we recognize them?
In a world in which nature and women are systematically exploited by a so-called free market ideology, there can be no environmental security. Rainforest dwellers, island peoples, the inhabitants of fragile, arid, or Arctic zones are threatened with displacement and dispossession due to human disruption and pollution of vulnerable ecosystems. In a world that condones such practices, there lies little hope for long-term survival or peace among peoples.
On a global level, the armed forces are not only the single largest consumers of petroleum and other rare minerals, they are also, most certainly, the largest polluters on Earth. Production, maintenance, and testing of conventional biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons produce uncontrolled quantities of toxic wastes, and the maneuvering of all the war paraphernalia leaves behind large tracts of dead land. These are the ghostly monuments, the sacrifice zones created by a global civilization which, during years spent on weapons, every 30 minutes the whole day round an amount of money equal to the annual budget of the UNEP, the program to safeguard the life-supporting systems of planet Earth. Such is the way to global homelessness for humanity.
Magda Renner of Brazil.
In 1985, women working for a nuclear-free and independent Pacific, a group active throughout Britain, organized a speaking tour in Europe for 9 indigenous Pacific women. I quote parts of their testimonies, published in a modest booklet. Why haven't you known? Why haven't you known about nuclear testing by the US, Britain, and France? About jellyfish babies born to women who were exposed to the tests? Why haven't you known about uranium mining and aboriginal land and nuclear waste dumping? One of these women recalls a day she'll never forget. It was in the year 1946, when the Navy official from the US came to the Bikini Island, and he told the Chief Judah, "We are testing these bombs for the good of mankind and to end all world wars." The Chief Judah did not understand English, but the word mankind stuck in his mind because he knew it from the Bible. So the chief gave the permission to the American official. When the Navy official came, it was too late. There were already thousands of soldiers and scientists on the atoll, and hundreds of airplanes and ships in the Bikini Lagoon. They were ready to conduct their tests. The Bikinians had no choice but to leave their islands, and they have never returned. The Navy official did not tell the chief that the Bikinians would not see their home again. Today, Bikini is off limits for 30,000 years. And there are other Pacific islands and other irradiated areas around our globe which are off limits for all times to come. Bikinians who have survived can't escape their remembrances. They suffer from homesickness, from ill health and cancer, and in their bodies they carry the seeds which generate abnormal children. Jellyfish babies have no eyes, no legs, no arms. Women who have nurtured them in their wombs get crazy when they see them. How many share their destiny among the survivors of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Chernobyl, or Bhopal? In our recent history, we have lived a moment of hope when the Cold War was over and world leaders started speaking of converting arms into plowshares. Then there came the Gulf War, to liberate Kuwait, to defend what is right, and to preserve the stability and the security of the Gulf, on which the U.S. vital national interests depend. The words are quoted from Mr. President Bush's address to the nation, March 91. Technology won the war, but it doesn't build peace. To the contrary, nations who can rely on such phenomenal technology arsenals, as we have seen during the Gulf War, will easily be tempted to use them even before exhausting all other possible ways to settle their disputes.
We believe that a healthy and sustainable environment is contingent upon respect for human rights, participatory democracy, the self-determination of peoples, respect for indigenous peoples and their lands, cultures, traditions, and the protection of all species.
Yes.
My name is Dagmar Thorpe. I'm Sack and Fox from Oklahoma.
And in addition to the issue of representation of Native American women, it's not only our numbers, but our worldview and our perspective that is critically missing here. The absolute bottom line has to be the natural world taking precedence over human beings. And that we as human beings are only a part of the entire natural world, and we are an interrelated and interconnected part of that. And that when in our relationships to the natural world, we need to give co-equal consideration to all of life. And all of life has an inherent right to its own existence, whether it's human, plant, or animal. And that we as human beings who were given the choice to support or to destroy life must view our role as caretaker rather than exploiter. That the natural laws that were given to all of us from the Creator and that are embodied in the spiritual traditions of human beings must take precedence over the laws of human beings. That the principle of only taking from the earth what is needed to maintain a simple life rather than what is desired as an extravagance must take precedence. And that finally, respect for the biodiversity includes not only the diversity of plant and animal life, but the diversity of human culture, spirituality, wisdom, and ways of life.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
We believe that basic human rights include access to clean air and water, food, shelter, health, and well-being. These rights are currently denied to millions of people, the overwhelming majority of whom are women. We are deeply troubled by the increasing inequities in the quality of life of those living in the industrialized nations and those of the so-called developing nations. We are outraged by the disparity between our children's nutrition, well-being, education, and opportunities for a full and productive life. We condemn the racism and disrespect of diversity on which this inequity feeds.
Laila Tackler, and I came from Cairo, Egypt, to attend this meeting with you. Somehow, somewhere, someone divided the world into first, second, and third world countries. And this someone must be a man. And let me tell you why. 10 years ago, in a meeting of all the world's parliaments, I told my colleagues from the so-called developed, rich, industrialized countries, you come to our countries with your factories, not because you love us, not because you want to develop us, but because you want to avoid taxes, you want cheap labor, and you want to evade strict rules and regulations of the environment. Why don't we? I suggested we have a code of ethics that when you come to our countries, you implement your laws and regulations and not ours. Now, those men were very angry at me. Today, when this suggestion was made, you wonderful ladies supported it and endorsed it, and this is why I am more sure that it is women who will make the difference.
Thank you.
How we get to that code of ethics, I have some ideas. I appealed to men when I was chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in our parliament, and they did not listen. But now I appeal to you ladies. There are no third world people.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We equate lack of political and individual will among world leaders, the great majority of whom are men, with a lack of basic morality and spiritual values and an absence of responsibility towards future generations.
Now, if we agree that we must reduce the depletion of the resources and that also that there is a need to lower the ecological costs of pollution, waste, and climate change, then it is inevitable that the volume of output has to go down.
Mina Rahman of Malaysia.
For instance, to save the forests, we have to reduce logging and cut down on the wasteful use of wood. But there is then the crucial question of sharing the burden of economically adjusting to an ecologically sound pattern of production and consumption. This is surely the heart of the issue at the onset, the international burden sharing and the burden sharing within nations. Now, at the international level, there are at least two ways adjustment will come about. One is the powerful countries say to us, I'm strong, you are weak, I want your resources that are getting more scarce. Give it to me. Too bad if you don't agree. In this context, we have what is called a triage, which is the strong throwing off the weak in order to have sovereignty over our resources. This is almost like colonial rule again. Now, the second approach, of course, is that we have a mutual problem as part of humanity, and the overriding principle is that we survive together. So, the issue is, I am strong, but perhaps I was wrong. In the colonial past and now in the present system, we have taken away from nature and your countries have become poorer. Frankly, we don't need so much to enjoy life, and we could adjust this unequal relation and have a true partnership that can save nature and our resources together. The second approach, of course, seems to be the only and the sane one.
Based on economic growth and ludicrous investments in weaponry, the current development model has wrought human and environmental degradation and destruction. Unbridled consumerism of the industrialized nations leads to unjust exploitation of human and natural resources of poor nations, which results in co-opting governments and the political process for the benefit of the few.
I find that the interpretation that Russia has changed its social structure, and this is for the better, is a very American interpretation.
Jocelyn Dow of Guyana.
And I find further that America uses capitalism, and I'm not even going to say democracy because they're defining democracy how they want. So in other words, they're saying that if you're a communist country or if you're a socialist country, democracy doesn't exist in it. And then they use that as a reason now to promote militarization and to undermine these countries. I think particularly in third world countries, capitalism is very destructive. The countries are small, the amount of resources you have is small. When you encourage that kind of individual greed and excessive growth, the poverty that results in these countries are almost uncontrollable, right? So I don't think that in any document that women have that they should talk about the changed conditions of the world, meaning that Russia has changed its stance. For that matter, many third world countries are trembling in fear at that change of stance, because it seems that if you just have the whole white world now consolidated against you, right? I think what should be emphasized instead is that countries have a right to choose those political structures that are best suited to their people and their resources, and no militarization should be forced on a country because they do not want to have an American model of development. It is not a model of development that is suited to many people.
We come together to pledge our commitment to the empowerment of women, the central and powerful force in the search for equity between and among peoples of the earth, and for a balance between them and the life support systems which sustain us all. We undertake our action agenda on behalf of our families and future generations. We appeal to all women and men to join in this call for profound and immediate transformation in human values and activities.
These deliberations you do today are significantly, if not fundamentally, connected to other agendas that seek environmentally sound and sustainable development that are taking place at the same time. We are part of a worldwide movement of women and men looking forward to the Earth Summit in Rio, working together and in coalition with many other groups to make certain that the UNCED meeting in Rio next June responds to our needs and hopes for a restored planet
And whether Rio makes it or not, and we have a responsibility to try to make it by moving our delegations, by moving our corporations, by moving our governments, who can ultimately move the United Nations. But whether or not Rio makes it or not, and I pray and hope that it will, we will continue to move. The women of this planet will continue to move, determined to embrace it, to make it ours, to love it, to nourish it, and make it flourish once again.
Bella Abzug, concluding part one of Frieda Worden's documentary, Agenda to Save the Planet, about the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet in Miami, 1991.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is In the Motherhood for Wednesday, November 17th. And this is a radio documentary created by Canadian radio show Wings with host Frieda Worden. And it's covering the Women's Agenda to Save the Planet, which happened 30 years ago in Miami. And it offers a historical context and some insights into our current climate crisis. I'm going to play the second half of this tribunal right now. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
It almost gets to be tiresome to have to continue and repeat, as we do, that women must be part of decision making. But if we keep saying it long enough and act upon it, as we're trying to do here, it will come about.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Bella Abzug convened 1,500 women from 83 countries to prepare a consensus document about what women want to see on the agenda of the June 1992 United Nations Conference on Environment and Development. A resolution calling for equal participation by women was the first item agreed upon by the participating nations in Rio. Now the issue is whether this was only lip service.
We're not going to ask for much. But for starters, a lot of talk has been made here about women's participation in decisions. So we suggest no more than 60% or less than 40% of either sex should be included in leadership posts in the United Nations, its specialized agencies and programs, in governments and public policy making groups in every region in the world, and especially in the member delegations that go to Rio in June. We're not going to ask for much. We only think we should get about half of international development funds and resources allocated to women's programs and projects in developing countries in compensation for 46 years of underfunding the needs of women and children, the poorest of the poor. We're not going to ask for much. We're going to ask for a very important thing, and that is that unless and until men and women together share in the responsibilities, share in the obligations, and share in the rights and the production and distribution in this world will not be able to continue.
Rosalie Bertel, a Canadian epidemiologist, was one of 15 experts who formally testified at the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. She was one of many whose testimony helped shape the Women, Militarism, and the Environment section of the 71-point Women's Action Agenda.
It's our earth. It's all we have. It's our air. It's our water. It's our food. It's babies. It's the future. And it has been seriously damaged and seriously jeopardized, which is why we are here. And I like the analogy of the bathtub, and I would like to put the plug in, because we can't keep running the water and having it run out. And I think the plug is the military, that we have to deal with that.
We demand nuclear weapons be dismantled and destroyed, that nuclear testing cease immediately. We've got lots more in this lot. We demand that space activities and supersonic flight, which threatens the ozone layer or releases carbon dioxide, cease. We urge an immediate 50% reduction in military spending. We demand creation of national civilian commissions with 50% membership of women, which would open to public scrutiny all military activities, expenditures, and research and development. We demand that national armies be converted into environmental protection corps, which would monitor and repair damage to natural systems, including cleanup of military bases, and be available to assist citizens in times of natural and man-made disasters. We condemn governments that turn their armies against their citizens, leading millions of individuals to become refugees and displaced persons. And we will educate our daughters and sons to shun military service if it is in the service of governments which use military power to exploit the resources and people of other nations.
The wars of the military-industrial complex, the bombs dropped there, now we're dying of cancer, the chickens are coming home to roost in our own environment.
While the wars have been fought, and we are supposedly at peace, the casualties of war are here. We are the casualties of war, especially the ones that live around the military facilities. And we're not recognized as such. But we are the ones that they experiment on first for the nuclear weapons and for all the weapons that they're making. And we are the ones that are, there's women that are bathing their babies in Rocky Mountain flats that have nerve gas products in their water.
The way we unmask the wolf in sheep's clothing is to find if they bring us poison, to find if they bring us sickness, to find if they bring us death. And we must uncover it. And we must demand accountability and destruction and elimination of this whole secret military system, which destroys our Earth and its livability. I think women are going to have to take the initiative, and women's groups are going to have to take the initiative to look at their own nation and to begin to issue report cards, to begin to say, are we going in the right direction or are we deteriorating? And if we are deteriorating, why? So one of the things that we're calling for political action is to begin to critically rate our own nations in terms of five things. One is the health of the natural environment. The second thing we'd like to look at is the health of the value system, which is motivating and driving our nation. The third thing is the health of the political system and the participatory nature of our nations. What kind of marks would they get? The fourth is the health of resource distribution and the households of our nation. And the last and fifth is the health of our human development systems. And I think the things we care about fall into all five categories. And I must thank Eva Nordland from Norway for pulling together the report card system and giving it life and bringing it to this conference.
We hope that someday, pretty soon, we will not only have a UN Security Council for military questions, but a UN Health Security Council. And we women can bring from all the countries in the world our report cards, what the progress is in our countries relating to the political system, the value system, the natural system, and our children and our old people. So this is the idea. Thank you very much.
Just a short question on the report cards about which you talked just now. Some of them seem to require a little more specialized knowledge to answer. So what sort of groups do you have in mind for filling in these report cards?
The report cards have two parts. One is a general overall estimate of your nation. You know, do we have problems in the area of our value system or our politics? And is anything being done about it? Has there been any progress? Are there efforts? Do we rate fairly well in this? And are we improving and are we sharing? There is a second section which is more quantified, which has to do with how much literacy in our country. What is the equity between genders in our country? How many people have shelter? How many people are malnourished? And so on. So there are some attempts also to quantify the health of our nation and to put these together to find the health of our region, the health of our world. Because it's only if we make progress on every one of these fronts that we will have a healthy planet.
We have to clear up the mess, so to speak, and therefore we have a right to question the people who created the mess. Should we also not insist that those who created the mess themselves clean it up also?
One of the five judges of the tribunal, Justice Sujata Manohar from the Bombay High Court, questions witness Peggy Antrobus, a development specialist from Barbados.
You asked, shouldn't the people who create the mess clean it up themselves? Yes, I mean, that is one of the things that... But if you ask the industrialists who are creating the mess to clean it up, it costs them more money, it'll affect their profits, and that is where the resistance comes from, because they're not prepared to do that.
We call for the creation of a permanent UN Environmental Commission to serve as an ombudsperson, receive individual complaints, monitor compliance, and enforce principles of an international code of environmental ethics. We require all states and corporations who produce toxic chemical agents to dispose of their toxic wastes within their own borders.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, another witness, is a former finance minister of Liberia and worked on trade issues for the World Bank.
Disproportionate distribution of and access to world resources has served to keep a few countries rich, very rich, and the majority of countries poor, very poor.
Jacqueline Pitangui, former president of the National Council of the Rights of Woman, Brazil.
I just wanted to bring another perspective to the discussion. It's not exactly a question, but I think that we have to think of logics and what kind of logics are going on maximization of profit and maximization of chances of survival. We cannot talk of environment without considering that the poor people and the poor people, which is the majority of the population in our countries, they are maximizing their chances of survival because there is a maximization of profit going on the economic values and on the market values. But the logic is the same. It's at the expenses of the nature. And it's to guarantee their survival today that they have to cut the trees, they have to put earth on an ecosystem and build a house there, or the floods will come and will destroy because there was deforestation. And I think that the North has pointed a finger to us too much, as though the poverty was not considered. So I think that North and South are linked by this logic of maximization of profit, which is perverse. It is a perverse trend because there is maximization of profit at the expenses of nature, which leads to the need to maximize the chances of survival also at the expenses of nature. And I think those two questions have to be considered when we talk about the value of ecosystems and find the measures to deal with it.
We call for the renegotiation of terms of trade that will ensure an equitable relationship between the price of raw materials and prices of manufactured goods.
A creative approach to trade imbalance and third world debt came out of discussion in a workshop.
I'd like to suggest, as a member of the third world, that one of the things for us that would equate the present debt we carry is if you did an environmental audit historically. We do an audit of the ecosystems as they existed in 1940s after the war. We see where they are, we see who the user was, and we see who the net beneficiary was. And if we can get a net beneficiary assessment, then for Guyana, we will know that Canada made money off of our bauxite, Britain made money out of our lumber, so-and-so made money out of thing, and maybe we can cancel our debt just based on that.
We suggest that historic audits of nation states from 1945 onward be conducted to determine the net beneficiaries of natural resource exploitation, an assessment which would serve as the basis of to cancel current debt.
Foreign debt is a matter of crucial importance to women in developing countries because it is being used by the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to force cuts in public services. Every lost daycare center or public bus or hospital bed or food subsidy or public sector job forces more unwaged work on women, whose contribution to sustaining life isn't counted in the gross domestic product.
We call for the rejection of structural adjustments policies, SAPs, which shift the responsibilities of basic social services from governments to women without compensation or assistance.
Nancy Barry is on leave from the World Bank to serve as president of Women's World Banking, which helps poor women start their own lending institutions.
What structural adjustment lending is balance of payment support, essentially in exchange for governments changing their macroeconomic policies and opening up their economies and reforming their financial systems and privatizing their public enterprises. The World Bank talks a lot about the supply response. Basically, the supply response means that economies grow, that exports improve, that poor people increase their income. And in order for that to happen, you cannot expect that you change the exchange rate, liberalize imports, and the rest will take care of itself. I mean, that is an absurd proposition. One of the things that the World Bank really needs to worry about now is getting more people at the technical level and at the managerial level who are not macroeconomists. One of the problems in going through 10 years of the macroeconomist as king is that even when the World Bank figures out, as it has internally, that structural adjustment has not worked terribly well and certainly not the way it was done, those are the people that are still running the show.
The ludicrous inadequacy of current economic theory was the text of testimony by Marilyn Waring, a well-known feminist economist and former member of New Zealand's parliament.
First of all, the boys are calling a whole new field of study ecological economics. It's a bit of a problem with eco, of course, the Greek derivation from home. The way the boys treat ecological economics, it doesn't have a great deal to do with home. It uses, it would be suggested, conventional economic tools, despite all the caveats which the boys enter about how these not really appropriate, and it's very difficult to cram them all into one system, etc. For those of you who aren't up with the play, growth is anything that passes through the market for which cash is exchanged. There isn't a debit side of growth, so it's not like running the housekeeping, and there isn't a legal or illegal demarcation either, so that it's really good for growth to smoke lots of cigarettes, have lots of car accidents, wars are sensational, a few eggs on Valdez's and icebergs are extremely good. I don't know why people worry about Noriega. I mean, illegal drugs are what a lot of the South even produces to even get any form of growth rate.
Waring's testimony brought about resolutions calling for differentiation between constructive and destructive production, and another opposing environmental accounting. Marilyn Waring.
We must fight very hard what is happening. The United Nations Statistical Office has already approved the establishment of environmental accounts inside the system of national accounts. They will involve the commodification of everything that can be perceived as having a market value. But these things are nightmares because, of course, national income accounting works inside nation states. And one of the things that nature can teach us, thankfully, is that it doesn't know anything about nation state boundaries. Is acid rain going to be recorded as a natural export to Canada? And quite where is Canada going to record this now in its income accounts? And the same for Norway. Is it going to think that it just got some aid from the UK when the next lot of acid rain hits? Or, you know, where is it quite supposed to pop it? And in the Pacific, when the French exploded another bomb in Mururoa, and we would just like to send it home to Paris, but it doesn't work like that. When we get our dead fish and our jelly babies and our leukemia, just quite where are we supposed to record this in our national income accounts? So I have some trouble with the fact that we even think that we can number crunch it inside a nation state context. But the inability to attribute a market value to part of the ecosystem doesn't mean that it's not worthy of consideration. But the treatment of the environment in national accounts and in public policy reproduces the arrogant ideology that only money is of value and only the market is a source of knowledge.
The Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development attended the final plenary of the Congress. He heard the statement by the five judges who weighed the formal testimony.
Secretary General Morris Strong and honored guests, I want to introduce them to you individually. The Honorable Justice Elizabeth Ebert from Australia, the Justice Desiree Bernard of Guyana, Justice Siyata V. Manohar from India, Lady Justice F.E.U.R. from Kenya, and Judge Margareta Watstein of Sweden. I now call upon the Honorable Justice Elizabeth Ebert of Australia to render the decision of the tribunal.
If I could turn now to what we've called the declaration of the tribunal of the Miami World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. We believe that to tackle the problems that have identified by the many speakers here at this Congress, the actions of state governments, international agencies, private organizations and individuals should be guided by three basic principles. They are first, global equity, second, resource ethics, and third, empowerment of women. As to global equity, the global environment is the necessary condition of life. As such, it cannot be the exclusive preserve of any individual. The principle of equity should guide states individually and collectively in determining who has access to and use of basic resources. The first priority should be given to meeting the basic human rights and needs of all people, especially the right of everyone to an adequate standard of living, including adequate food, clothing and housing, and to the continuous improvement of living conditions. I quote there from the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. Those principles should guide financial and economic policies. The second principle, resource ethics. The use of natural resources should be guided by ethical principles which balance the need for material progress with the sustainability of resources and which base living standards on long-term sustainability and on responsibility towards future generations. The third principle is the empowerment of women. The women's perspective, which recognizes that meeting human and social needs is a goal of higher importance than economic progress for its own sake, must be brought to bear on global problems of environmental destruction and poverty arising from inequitable access to necessary survival resources. Women must be empowered at all levels to contribute to the achievement of the principles of equity, social justice, and ethics.
In responding to the women's agenda, Secretary General Strong pointed out it would be difficult to get substantive results from the Earth Summit in Brazil. Magda Renner, spokesperson on environment for Brazil's National Confederation of Women, offers advice for the event.
I have been for 2 years at the NGO World Bank Committee and always behaving very well and writing hundreds of papers and making thousands of suggestions, which then always were considered very enlightening, but nothing happened. But when we went into the streets with our big banners, standing in New York where it was forbidden to stay, and the police came, then it was an affair, and then suddenly all those men started listening to what we were saying. So we must be visible when all the dignitaries, the powerful men are coming to Brazil in Rio de Janeiro. We must be there, we must be standing in the streets. We must be crying out at them. We don't not behaving so well as we always do, just standing there. Yeah, it's true. Just standing, just hearing, and not having the possibility to speak. So if we don't have the possibility to speak during the official meetings, let us stand in the streets where those men have to pass to go into their beautiful cars. And let us make our demonstrations there.
Give us back our rainforest in the heart of the Amazon. Give us back our oceans pure as they were when the world was young. Give us back our air so sweet that the beat on nature runs. Let the hungry child be fed the sand and the love.
This concludes the two-part documentary, Agenda to Save the Planet, produced by Frieda Worden and funded by Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. For more about WINGS, email wings@wings.org. WINGS' current supporters include your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose website gifteconomy.com has videos of all plenaries from the World Women's Congress for a Healthy Planet. She hosts new videos at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Old WINGS sound logo you heard in this show was created by Maggie Payne. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
What you've been listening to here on CKT 90.3 FM is a radio documentary that was created by a Canadian radio show, Wings, with host Frieda Worden. And it covers the women's agenda to save the planet, which happened 30 years ago It offers a glimpse into history and the climate action that was happening that long ago, and as well as some insights into our current climate crisis, even though we are living in a very different time, of course, with the internet, with social media, but we're still facing similar institutional and psychological barriers. So thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is In the Motherhood. Thank you to Wings for letting us borrow this content. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. Thanks for listening and have a great night.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Amanda, your weekly broadcast from Doug Miller and Gwen Schulman here at CKUT 90.